You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, most of us have moved on from the sourdough bread baking by now, but 2020 has been a year of cooking experiments and comfort foods for many of us. We'll talk about how food has helped us get through the uncertainty. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic has upended our daily norms, from grocery shopping to seeing family or friends. But public health crises throughout American history have also shaped another part of our lives, the law. From smallpox to the COVID-19 pandemic, laws have been shaped by epidemics, and the law has also had the power to impact how those outbreaks play out. Our next guest joins us to talk about how the law, government, and public health interact historically in the United States and how we can learn from the past for the COVID-19 pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How should the legal system balance public health and safety measures against possible infringements on personal rights? Who should have the most power to react to outbreaks, national, state, or local governments? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. John Fabian Witt is the Allen H. Duffy Class of 1960 Professor of Law at Yale Law School. He's the author of multiple books. His latest is called American Contagions, Epidemics and the Law from Smallpox to COVID-19. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. I'm glad to be here.
In the book, you make the case for why we should look back at the past of pandemics and our legal system in the United States. What kind of things can we learn by delving into the past like that?
Well, you know, for the last three quarters of a century, Americans have forgotten what a pandemic can do, and we've lost touch with the kinds of legal requirements and legal rules that we need to have in place to protect ourselves. And in some sense, we're back to the 19th century. And what better place to look than the 19th century to figure out some of the kinds of things that democratic communities have been able to accomplish in moments like this?
And this used to be more the norm. We had a lot more diseases to contend with, outbreaks, local or national. This was a very live issue throughout, as you say, the 19th century, from the birth of the country, right?
Oh, for sure. So from the 1780s and 90s with yellow fever and smallpox and measles and cholera in the middle of the 19th century, our ancestors, our forefathers, as we might say in constitutional language, you know, were used to these things. They were standard operating procedure, and they reorganized the world we live in to deal with them. The cities we live in, the towns, have rules about nuisances and where you can do what that are organized around and rooted in a long history of regulating for the common good.
A key point, though, that you raised early in your book is that the founders and beyond recognized the interests of government in regulating issues related to health, but they really put the power in the hands of state and local governments, not the federal government. Why was that, and why has that been an important factor?
Well, the power is the police power, you know, and it has nothing to do with troopers on the highway or cops on the beat. It's the basic power to look after the people in a community. And the U.S. Constitution, 1787, allocates that authority to the states and gives certain enumerated powers to the federal government. But that basic police power is a state power, not police power. And it's been that way in the U.S. All the way back, and it's really shaping right now. You can see it shaping our response here in 2020. If you want to see the history of the law matter, look at the way in which the United States has responded to COVID-19. It's states and localities.
We've seen legal challenges right from the start. How did we start to define what a state or local government can and can't do when it comes to regulating public health in the face of an outbreak?
So in the decades after the Constitution is ratified, courts uphold vast authorities for state governments. You know, you got to fight smallpox, you got to fight cholera, you got to be able to do that. And it has to be able to regulate the way people live in order to keep people safe and let people be free. Both those things rest on holding epidemics at bay. What courts have done over our history is make sure that elected officials stay within legislative boundaries. They've tried to make sure that state officials respond to the electorate and respond responsibly. What they haven't done is step in and prevent elected officials from doing what needs to be done. That's been the historical tradition.
Talking to John Fabian Witt, author of the book American Contagions, Epidemics and the Law from Smallpox to COVID-19. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. I'm looking, John, at a description you give. The Wisconsin Supreme Court blocking a state board of health effort in the midst of an outbreak, saying they have statutory authority to do things, but it exceeded its powers. The year is not 2020. The year is 1877. But the sentence would apply equally well to 2020. We keep doing the same things here.
Right. There are a lot of historical resonances. Americans have been challenging the legality of epidemic response, way back into the 19th century. There's an important difference emerging, though, right now, Rob, and it's one that I think we should all pay attention to and figure out what we think about. The tradition, 1877 Wisconsin, even spring 2020 Wisconsin, has been to insist that governors, mayors follow the rules set out by a legislature. But we've got a new set of cases being decided by courts around the country. And to be honest, the spring 2020 Wisconsin Supreme Court went a little bit in this direction, saying, actually, legislatures don't have the power to respond to pandemics. The freedom of the individual matters too much. And that's a worrisome development, because actually the freedom of the individual requires that we restrain one another to manage for our own health and safety.
And that's a key distinction. And you talk about this a lot in the midst of 19th century outbreaks or preparing for them. That idea that you just outlined, that we have to protect individuals and individual liberty. In some cases, the argument went by regulating their lives in ways to protect public health. That was the guiding principle, it seemed like, for a long time. Not that we ignored civil liberties, but they weren't the be-all and end-all.
That's right. I mean, Justice John Marshall Harlan, in a really important case called Jacobson against Massachusetts in 1905, says, real liberty is the liberty to go about your life confident that you won't get smallpox from someone who's near you. And that's the real liberty that he was interested in. We see that run all the way through the 19th century, back right to the founding.
Another running argument you lay out is kind of two schools of thought in public health, and this ends up in the courts, a sanitation school versus a quarantine philosophy. Can you lay out that tension?
Right. Well, you can either control bodies, think quarantines, set down a cordon sanitaire, a limit on where people can go, a constraint on their freedom, or you can try to lift up the conditions in which people live. You can engage in tenement reform or clean the streets or something like that. And those two different strategies, one authoritarian, the other, call it liberal or progressive, but I don't mean to invoke any political categories from today. But one is attending to people's circumstances, and the other is attending to their bodies. And we've got both those traditions in American history running all the way through.
And another theme that runs through here is that the people subjected to the most stringent quarantines and treatments sometimes are the most vulnerable population. Immigrants, in some cases, poor people, Black people, people with HIV during the AIDS crisis. The standards don't always get applied equally.
For sure. I mean, this awesome power, the police power to look out for communities, it's a little bit like the power to look out for communities in moments of war. These are emergencies of a certain kind. And that's an awesome and terrifying power, even if it's one we have to have. And of course, awesome power can be abused. And so we've got terrible examples of that in American history, from ignoring a smallpox epidemic among enslaved people during the Civil War, to targeted quarantines at the Chinese in the Pacific Northwest around the turn of the 20th century. Think of the Tuskegee experiments, terrible experiments on Black men with asymptomatic syphilis all through the middle of the 20th century, and then up to the way in which HIV/AIDS gets ignored in the 1980s. So long history of the abuse of this terrible power, even though it's one we absolutely have to have.
And it ends up being counterproductive in some cases, John. You lay out cases where some of the groups you just talked about distrusted future public health efforts because those previous ones had been legitimately unfair to them.
For sure. I mean, that's one of the paradoxes of the law of public health. And you might think of the job of judges in these areas, in this public health area, as to try to do their best to make sure that legislatures are living up and governors are living up to their word, to try to channel official action, which is, of course, us trying to do the right thing to help our communities be healthy, to channel that official action into trustworthy, publicly accountable pathways. And that maybe that's the best way to build trust, which absolutely we need at these times. And of course, we don't really have right now.
We're talking to John Fabian Witt right now. He's a professor of law at Yale Law School. He's the author of the new book, American Contagions, Epidemics and the Law, From Smallpox to COVID-19. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think of our American system of public health, how we divide up the authority? Do you think the federal government should have more power than it does in our system? Or do you think it's right to leave things up to state and local governments? Do you want to see more cooperation among these smaller units of government? If so, what questions do you have about how law has affected diseases and diseases have affected the law since the beginning of American history? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And where do you draw the line, or where do you think the law should draw the line between, you know, people being compelled for certain behaviors to protect public health versus concerns about civil rights and civil liberties? 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the intersection of history, law, and public health crises with John Fabian Witt, professor of law at Yale Law School. His latest book is American Contagions, Epidemics and the Law, From Smallpox to COVID-19. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of legal challenges to public health emergency efforts here in 2020, here in Wisconsin, and how the courts have ruled on them? What do you think the role of the federal versus the state government should be when it comes to preventing and stopping pandemics? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And John, let's talk about that last point. We've got the states taking the lead, and it's been kind of a piecemeal effort, clearly, with COVID-19. Is there a need, do you think, to revisit that division of labor?
Well, there's a need for more coordination. The pandemic affects different places in different ways at different times. That's been one of the lessons of the last 8, 9, 10 months. On the other hand, the pandemic doesn't get limited to one place. That's another one of the lessons. And so some kind of centralized coordination, even if it's just in the form of the use of the bully pulpit or some kind of inducements from the federal government to the states. So federal leadership would be useful. States will also continue to play a central role, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Does the law need to be clarified on this, or is this a practice thing that of what people are actually doing? Do we need to revisit our state and federal laws when it comes to pandemics?
Well, one of the important questions has been civil liberties as against the power of the government, right? And that you've brought that out from the beginning. And over the last couple decades, one of the interesting things is that public health authorities have been calling on states to respect civil liberties in moments of disease or for the pursuit of public health, in part to build trust with vulnerable communities. This is something we talked about before your break. And one of the interesting and scary things we're seeing right now is that new technologies might allow states to manage and police populations without their trust. That is, think of the smartphone or cell phone technologies that allow states to track people. So we're at a complicated juncture where some scary new developments could happen, and we got to keep an eye on those.
We are talking about pandemics and the American legal system. You can join in at 800-642-1234 in the conversation with John Fabian Witt, author of American Contagions. Let's bring on a caller now. John is with us in Rice Lake. John, hi.
Hello there.
What do you want to bring up, John?
So I'm a physician, and I obviously practice in the state of Wisconsin, and with the recent rulings that have come out of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, we have one of the dumbest Supreme Courts in the entire country, and lawyers know nothing about medicine, and I happen to have friends that are lawyers, but they know nothing about medicine, and I firmly believe lawyers and the courts should stay out of this whole argument, and it should be left up to the doctors to settle, because we understand what's going on.
John, thanks a lot for the call. And John Fabian Witt, this is a tension that's been there all along when courts and judges and lawyers are trying to sort out these public health and medical issues.
Well, you know, for sure, for precisely John's reason, courts, judges have oftentimes not wanted to step in American history for fear of looking foolish. I mean, a smart judge knows that they're not experts in public health science, that they're not physicians, they're not scientists. And so they've wanted to do is manage the process to push legislatures to respond rationally to new scientific information and not step in and decide things on their own. But just as your caller suggests, we've seen some courts, Wisconsin, Michigan, a federal court in Pennsylvania, going a lot further and imposing their own view with potentially catastrophic results.
But on the opposite side of John's argument, doctors aren't lawyers. And these judges and lawyers are weighing not just the health and medical impacts, but the impacts on individual rights, hopefully on the rights, I guess, of communities, of vulnerable communities. They're looking at more than just the medical side of things.
For sure. And it's a delicate balance. You know, in that Jacobson against Massachusetts case upholding in 1905 mandatory vaccination in Cambridge, Massachusetts, what the Supreme Court says is a city can engage in mandatory vaccination, let the science lead. But the Supreme Court says, we're not going to get out of the business entirely. We're going to make sure that if there's some especially capricious or cruel or unusual vaccination, then we'll take a second look. So courts haven't been willing to leave the field altogether.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on now Jesse in Madison. Jesse, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jesse?
So earlier conversation this week that was happening was with one of the Republican legislators who had said Evers has not worked with local municipalities to enforce the mandate. And I think it's interesting the duality between legislature and lawmakers making laws and the police enforcing them. If Evers is to put forth a mandate that isn't a law, and then he's then supposed to reach out to local municipalities to enforce that law, how are they to enforce it if it's not a law, and how is he to be held accountable?
Jesse, thanks a lot for the call. So, yeah, Governor Evers issuing mandates, citing a law, giving him emergency powers or giving the health department emergency powers. Those have been challenged in courts, of course. But then that we've seen in Wisconsin and other states around the country, John, local sheriffs saying, for example, they're not going to enforce this order. Can you talk about the state and local tension over orders like these?
Well, this too is a tough balance. You know, 102 years ago this fall in San Francisco, there were a bunch of protests over mandatory mask laws during the 1918 influenza. And the San Francisco police enforced the mask law for a long time. There were tickets given out and pretty substantial for 1918 fines handed out. And it produced a backlash. An anti-mask league emerged. And much of the politics of masks that we have today, we could see 102 years ago. And the lesson there is that local enforcement has to use good judgment. We're really not going to be able to get away from the importance of communities and individuals using good judgment. And right now in our low trust, highly partisan, polarized moment, it's hard to see good judgment. And that's one of our crises.
Jesse, thanks for that call. Dave joins us next in Wausau. Dave, hi.
Hey guys, thanks for taking my call. Thanks for taking my call. Thanks for doing what you guys do. I appreciate everything you guys do. Second of all, it sounds like you're advocating, our professor here is advocating for more federal regulation in terms of mandates and that sort of thing. However, there is a massive difference between what happened in New York versus what happened in Wisconsin versus what happens in Montana. There is a specific law And I know that one caller said that doctors know more than lawyers, but there is a law. There's a specific law that says that a health emergency cannot last more than 60 days in Wisconsin. And that is not a federal law. That's a Wisconsin law. And it doesn't matter what the doctors say. Doctors are not economists. Economists know as much as doctors in different different facets. So with that being said, when we in Wisconsin enacted our 60-day mandate, we did that way early, way early. I mean, and if we were to take it into account the fact that there was only a 60-day mandate allowable in terms of legalese,
I got you, Dave. We don't have much time left. I'm going to jump in. First of all, John, I don't know that you were making the case that there needs to be more direct federal regulation within states, but you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, you just need to coordinate, right? That is, as long as Wisconsinites can go to Michigan, can go to Illinois, can eventually make their way to Connecticut, where I'm talking to you from tonight, then we need some kind of mechanism for coordination. And obviously, there's such a long tradition of really effective local control on these things. One wouldn't want to get away from that too much.
And as we wrap up, John, he was also mentioning we have this 60-day emergency thing, emergency law. But a pandemic doesn't necessarily work at our timetables. The law as it exists don't always match up with the next crisis, do they?
Right. If only the virus would respect the 60-day mandate. You know, that's one of those things designed to ask our democratic institutions, our communities to revisit basic questions of emergency policy. And so many of our political institutions right now are badly broken and are having a hard time revisiting it. And the project for regulating our country going forward, just like the pandemic going forward, is rebuilding that trust.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
John Fabian Witt is a professor of law at Yale Law School. His latest book is American Contagions, Epidemics and the Law from Smallpox to COVID-19. Coming up, have you been stressed out about your stress eating? It's been a year full of moments that could have you popping open that bag of chips. We'll look at 2020 through the lens of food. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, how do you square the need to stay home and stay safe with all the things we love about Thanksgiving? Millions are longing to check in on parents and old friends, but is no plan your best plan for the holidays this year? That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, no matter how much or how little your life has changed in the last 8 months, one thing that's remained a necessity for everyone and a comfort for most of us, I think, food. And some of us might find this relatable.
No, 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 no. That's impossible. You can't be out of food. What? Where's my personal reserve of moose juice and goose juice? My emergency stash of Hoo Hash? And my secret slew of frozen beezelnut stew? I specifically bought enough food to last until January. How much emotional eating have I been doing?
That's from the 2018 rendition of the Grinch movie, and maybe you, like the Grinch, have been reaching for comfort food, emotional eating, stocking up the pantry. You're not alone, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What has been a comfort food for you in the last few months? Have you found yourself doing some emotional eating? What's become a go-to food to make and or eat in the last few months? How has food shaped your life since the pandemic started? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Emily Contois is an assistant professor of media studies at the University of Tulsa. She explores the connections between food, the body, and health, and identities in contemporary U.S. media and popular culture. Her new book is called Diners, Dudes, and Diets, How Gender and Power Collide in Food, Media, and Culture. Emily, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Well, I know you look a lot at what the food we eat says about who we are. What are you seeing? What kind of trends and changes have you seen in this weird year of 2020?
So I love that we're focusing on comfort food. I had to hold in my laughter when we were listening to that clip from The Grinch, but I think it is so relatable that this has been a really hard year for those of us eating, that we've had to give up, a lot of us, right, going to restaurants for safety. Some of us have leaned in to new skills at home, whether it was getting, you know, very into baking, making our own sourdough bread. And then some of us, right, this has been so exhausting and so hard that we are turning to some of those like family favorites or childhood favorites for that comfort, that we've seen, you know, big changes in how we shop, how we eat, where we eat, who we eat with. I mean, name the change. We've seen it in 2020.
And now that was from a movie in 2018, that Grinch we heard there. But it rings especially true now. We all have those moments where we want to eat a particular thing in a moment of stress, but we've had a year of stress in a lot of ways. How does that affect the choices we make?
Absolutely. So emotional eating from a, you know, public health standpoint, right? We're often encouraged to be in tune with our emotions, right? To think about how and why we're eating, trying to guide ourselves to make healthful choices. But the fact is that turning to food in these moments that have been so hard is very human, right? Maybe I will be too generous with all of our listeners, but you have my permission, right? To be able to reach for that cookie, or to have that favorite snack, to make your grandma's recipe for mac and cheese, that it makes a lot of physiological, psychological, and social sense that we turn to food to be able to find that comfort, whether it's eating for emotions we're feeling, stress we're experiencing, or out of boredom, right? I think people have experienced the pandemic very differently based upon your job, your social position. All of our experience hasn't been the same. So we could be turning to food in different ways too.
And we've talked to you in the past about our snack choices. Comfort food doesn't necessarily have to be junk food or snacks. Well, let's start with you, Emily. What do you like when you think comfort food? What is in your head?
I do think of those like high fat, high carb things like mac and cheese and mashed potatoes and chips. But there's been really interesting research, right? Thinking about comfort food. And so I think one thing to remember is that it's not culturally homogenous, right? Depending upon our own backgrounds, our families, we might consider, you know, what counts as comfort food really different. But I love these categories that researchers came up with in an article that was in Food and Foodways. And so they categorize food, comfort food, as nostalgic, indulgent, convenient, or providing physical comfort. And so we can see how that would map onto really different foods, some of which could be snacky processed foods, right? That maybe were special treats when we were a kid that bring back that sort of nostalgic sense of comfort. But something that's indulgent, right? That could be something we're spending hours in the kitchen creating or buying from our favorite restaurant. But that idea of convenience, I know we talked about that with snacks as well. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the food that's the most comforting, right, is the one that's convenient, that's going to be easiest for us to pick up for ourselves or to feed our families. And then that idea of physical comfort, right, that we turn to this food because it makes us feel good, to sort of quell those emotions, but also in our bodies, right? There is that sensation of actual comfort.
We're talking to Emily Contois, assistant professor of media studies at the University of Tulsa, looking at how our relationship to food is changing in 2020, especially amidst the pandemic, and especially comfort food, the foods we turn to when times are tough. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's yours? What is your comfort food? Has it changed? It's been a long stretch here. Have you evolved new kinds of comfort food? Have you learned to make new ones, or sought out other ones? Did you start off unhealthy and try to move it up a notch in the health department? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Emily, part of the story here is, you know, we can't necessarily share these foods in person. But we already had a trend, I think, of people sharing their meals on social media. And just from where I'm sitting, that's accelerated a lot. Can you talk about how we are performing our food on social media?
Absolutely. So I always like to say that the idea you are what you eat has transformed into you are what you post, right? It's what we share on social media. That's how we document, you know, some folks, right? That's how we document what we've eaten to be able to share that with the broader world. And so I teach a class on food media where one of the assignments is for the students to have a food Instagram account and sort of experience that if they didn't already take photos of food, to lean into that, to share creations that they cooked that they were proud of. But one of the things the students were kind of nervous about, because we're taking this class this semester, which has been almost entirely right during the pandemic, that they knew they weren't going to be going to restaurants probably and being able to take pictures of what they considered Instagrammable, right, or Insta-worthy food. And so there is this sort of level of expectation of how beautiful, right, the food should be for us to share it. And so we've seen, you know, people taking pictures of the, you know, home cooked creations that they felt like they had new time, new skill, new space to explore and discover, to share that proudly on social media. But it's been interesting to see social media also be a space, you know, sharing when you are eating out. That is, we talk about, you know, different people's comfort level of going out to eat again, of being in public spaces, of thinking about social distancing. Social media has become this interesting space, right, to feel like you're missing out, which was always there. But the pandemic has heightened that in different ways when we think about safety, too.
How about food marketing? Is that something you're watching? And what have you seen, whether it's restaurants or restaurant chains or, you know, packaged food manufacturers or whatever, how are they selling us food, if at all, differently now nowadays?
So food brands, as well as lots of others, when we were first in those months of, you know, lockdown and, you know, really experiencing the beginning of the pandemic in the United States, you see lots of messages of, we are in this together, right? Like, we are going to help you through this. And then there was messaging about how to make sure that food delivery was safe, right? To be able to address consumer concerns about, was it safe to get food delivered from your local restaurant? And that hasn't played out evenly, right? The pandemic has been huge in affecting small businesses, right? Of how many small local restaurants we might lose. But it has been sort of fortuitous for some brands. Domino's, for example, has been able to hire even more workers, right? Like hiring, ordering delivery pizza has definitely been something that folks have been doing, have felt safe doing, and that brand has really leaned into. So it's played out differently depending upon, you know, what food company it is.
We are talking about food during the pandemic. What is a comfort food? How are we eating differently? How are we talking about it and sharing it differently on social media? Emily Contois is with us, assistant professor of media studies at the University of Tulsa. She researches the connections between food and our identity. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What has been your go-to comfort food or snack food lately? Have you found your mood and your food connected? Have you been an emotional eater lately? How has food or cooking helped you get through 2020? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about food and how it's helped us get through 2020. Emily Contois is with us, assistant professor of media studies at the University of Tulsa. Her research explores connections between food and our identities, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us your go-to comfort food or snack. Have you been enjoying some maybe childhood favorites? Have you learned a whole new kitchen skill with your pandemic downtime? And how about emotional eating? Is it a thing for you? It's a thing for me sometimes. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Susie is with us in Williams Bay. Susie, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share that the first new recipe I tried back last March when the pandemic got going, I tried a recipe for chicken enchiladas, and it turned out just great, and it's just a fun thing to make. It's something out of the ordinary, and it's kind of a go-to recipe now for me.
Fantastic, Susie. And have you tried, like, you know, jazzing it up in different ways, or you stick with the same recipe most times?
Well, sometimes you can vary the type of tortilla you use, maybe a spinach tortilla or a tomato tortilla, something like that. But the filling's basically the same. And you just put the tortillas in a regular glass baking dish and cover it with foil, and you've got delicious chicken enchiladas.
Fantastic. Susie, thanks a lot. And that, Emily, hits a lot of my buttons for comfort food. Warm, tasty, gooey, especially when it's cold now. Get the oven on. I think for a lot of people, that that recipe Susie picked up earlier this year will be comforting.
Absolutely. I agree. A really good one to choose from a nutritional perspective, the textures, the flavors. Now, I bet that would resonate with a lot of people. And interesting to hear, right, that this was the moment that she was going to try something new. I think that's what's been so interesting to see how the pandemic played out differently for different people, whether to go back to tried and true recipes that were from our family or that we're really familiar with, or to try something new. And interesting to have that be, you know, a new recipe for her in her repertoire that she really likes now.
Susie, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Emily, I know early on in the pandemic, we were, you know, stores were running out of things like flour and yeast as people got into baking or back into baking. And one case I heard was, hey, maybe this is, we're a little uncertain about what's going on in the world. We're not sure what's going to happen next. We can take control of this little piece of our life by learning to make this new kind of food for ourselves. Do you think there's anything to that?
I think there's tons to that. We've seen that throughout history. Moments of, you know, significant, you know, social, cultural, economic, political strife are ones in which we often turn inward into our food to find the answers, the control, the connection in the way that we eat, the way we cook, the way we share it with those around us. That because food is so intimate, so special, that it becomes a part of our bodies as we eat it, I think it makes total sense that we try to find that feeling of control, security, and comfort in food.
Susie, thanks a lot again for calling in. We'll go to Lissa now in Partyville. Lissa, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What'd you want to tell us about, Lissa?
So I'm an essential worker, and COVID has just been crazy, pulling us in 10 different directions every day, trying to cover places that have been losing workers left and right because of this. And Quick Trip has been a savior for my family. They have these take-home meals that cover like a whole range with mac and cheese and spaghetti. And I'm an awful cook. And so they've just been a lifesaver for us.
And Lissa, can I ask what kind of work do you do?
I actually work in the convenience store industry for grocery and such.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. A lot of demand for groceries of all sorts. Thanks a lot for calling in, Lissa. And that dependence on quick and easy, convenient food. I'm not in her situation, but I definitely have turned to that a lot myself. And delivery restaurants, I know, and takeout restaurants doing a heavy business too, Emily.
Yes, absolutely. And that, you know, we just talked about those categories, right, for comfort food, that, you know, intersection of convenient and indulgent and nostalgic, right, that a take-home mac and cheese, you know, hits all those buttons. And to think, right, of the extra pressure of being an essential worker, that as we think about how this pandemic has played out differently based upon your job, based upon your family status, that, you know, to thank Lisa so much for her service, right, to be in this position where she's in that essential line, that I'm so glad she's finding food that still feeds her family, makes everyone happy, and is getting us through this.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking about food in 2020, food during the pandemic. Emily Contois is with us, assistant professor of media studies at the University of Tulsa. You could still join in. What is your comfort food? 800-642-1234. Is there a snack that you reach for maybe more often than you'd like? Is there a meal you like to cook or buy or do takeout, whatever, that really comforts you? What is it? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, Emily, I know people look a lot at the future of food when we're through all of this. Hopefully that is soon. Will we have established new patterns? Maybe we're cooking at home more and we're happy to stay that way? Or are we all just going to be eager to go back into restaurants? I know we can't predict the future, but what are you looking for?
I just did a sort of whole assignment with my students tracking their pandemic food ways and like what they missed the most. And it was restaurants. They all miss restaurants so much. They're so excited to be able to go back, not just to experience, the full, takeout is wonderful, but it's not the same depending upon right where you're ordering your food as being there in person. So I think they will definitely, right, we will not only eat at restaurants, but we will appreciate them so much more. But we've also seen trends, changing in shopping patterns, the idea that online ordering or curbside pickup, that some of these services that have been customized to the context of the pandemic, they might become more of a part of the menu of how we shop and of what we expect from the food industry. So it is very, very interesting to see how that will shake out in ways that might make for some really meaningful changes for consumers that maybe we wanted for a long time that will make it easier, sort of like Lisa, right, to be able to pick up a healthy meal for your family on the way home from work, that there might be some changes that make eating, well and joyfully and with our families easier than before.
Let's bring on another caller now. Michelle is with us in Osseo. Michelle, hi. Michelle, are you there? I don't think we have Michelle. Gave us a note. Oh, there you are. Hi. What did you want to tell us?
Well, we have been doing a lot of activities outside, social distancing. We're fishing a lot this summer. One of the places we fished has an overrun of bass, and so we ended up with a lot of fish to cook. And what I ended up doing was baking it with like Old Bay and dill, and taking the meat off and keeping it, and then using that to make crab cakes. And we have our own hens, and so the eggs are awesome, and making different recipes, trying to develop different recipes to make crab cakes.
Michelle, thank you so much. When life gives you bass, you make bass cakes. But I love that, Emily, because it's not just about the food here, but it's about the safe, socially distanced activity, in this case, fishing, that makes it all possible.
Absolutely. I think another one of those changes some people experienced during the pandemic was maybe having the time and the space to start gardening, right? To grow herbs on the kitchen counter. And then I love this story of having the experience, go out and fish, to go out and to be able to procure and produce food in a different way. So what a great story. I'd love to try her bass cakes. That's fascinating.
It sounds really good. Love the Old Bay seasoning. Tanya joins us next in Madison. Tanya, hi.
Hi, I've been eating an awful lot of Blue Moon ice cream.
Ooh, now, is Blue Moon, was that like a flavor for you as a kid, Tanya, or is this an adult discovery for you?
It is definitely a flavor from my childhood.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. Madison has chocolate shop ice cream, and if you take the Zanzibar chocolate and the Blue Moon, that's called Dark Side of the Moon, and it is delicious. And another plug for Quick Trip, they have Blue Moon ice cream for less than $3 for a small tub. And it's soft and creamy and delicious, and it's a comfort food.
Tanya, thank you so much. I can't believe I didn't bring that up. Emily, ice cream is, in a lot of ways, I think for a lot of people, a big comfort food or emotional eating food.
Absolutely. I will out my husband that is his food, right? Ice cream and cake. They have been in our house on a weekly basis these past months. So can definitely relate and really want to try the exact type that she's describing. Sounds amazing.
Thanks a lot for that call, Tanya. Emily, in our last few moments, food, it's clear it isn't just about the nutrients we're taking in. There's a lot in our identity and our society, too, in the foods we choose to eat.
Absolutely. I think one of the special things about comfort food is that it communicates both this feeling of like social and family connection, that it can be about belonging, right? With our memories, with people who maybe we can't see right now. I know some of us might be really distraught that we don't get to have a normal Thanksgiving this year to share that meal together. And so comfort food it's about belonging and that loneliness together, that it's able to help us navigate both of those really complex feelings. And so, just like any food experience in which we can read so much deep, complex meaning, comfort food gives us as well. And so, as I said, I hope everyone is finding that solace, that comfort in food during this really difficult time.
Emily, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Emily Contois is an assistant professor of media studies at the University of Tulsa. Her research looks at the connections between food, the body, health, and identity in contemporary U.S. media and popular culture. She has a new book out. It's called Diners, Dudes, and Diets, How Gender and Power Collide in Food, Media, and Culture. Should probably talk to her about that sometime. We talked about 2020 through the lens of food. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, it's a weekly look at personal finance, this time with a focus on wills and advance directives, how to do them, and who needs to do them. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then Wisconsin's own Richard Davidson joins the show with lots of practical advice to help us manage stress and anxiety in uncertain times, including some lessons from masters of mindfulness from around the world. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.